make him an offer he can't refuse.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the picture that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to all of you out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network and our Front Row Classics. I'm your host, Brandon Davis. And we are here now in the month of February. It is Valentine's month, so we decided to bring you a couple of romantic comedies this month, and we are starting with the Best Picture winner of 1977, Annie Hall, otherwise known as the movie that beat Star Wars, and a lot of other stuff. So we'll get into it here. A lot to talk about with this one, but joining me once again is my co-host, Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
It's going pretty well, Brandon. How are you?
Not bad. We'll keep rolling into 2021 already in the second month. So
yeah.
Well, hopefully we keep going uphill.
Yeah, yes, indeed.
And also joining us once again from Front Row Flashbacks is our friend Aaron McCabe. How's it going, Aaron?
Good. I love being on the show with you guys because there's so many classics that are on my list of movies to get to, and I never get to them. So I always love coming on here because you guys hit me up with the real prestige stuff, which we can't always say on Flashbacks.
So was Annie Hall, was this one that you had seen before, or was this something new for you?
No, this was new for me in a movie that had always been like, I've always heard it referenced. I've known about it, but never actually seen it. So this was a first time viewing.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, Eric, for those of our listeners who have not seen it before, I would suggest watching it first and then listening to us. But if you are, Eric, can you provide just
pause
a,
it? Yeah, right. Pause this right now and go. Yeah. Take the 90 minutes or so, because it's not a long film. And it's a plot that is pretty well known. It's a romantic comedy. So it's, you know, and it's kind of along the veins of Guy Meets Girl. Although it's a little different here because in this one, it sort of starts with our two main characters having been broken up. And so we know that. So there's no what's going to happen at the end of this movie. Are they going to get together or not? So we know that our main characters aren't together. And then we kind of go back in time to see the relationship from beginning all the way through that breakup between Woody Allen and Diane Keaton, our main players and their main characters. We get a little bit more of Woody Allen's Alvy Singer's character through some flashbacks to his early life. But we learn about their relationship and bounce back and forth between New York City and Los Angeles until finally they have an official breakup at the end of the movie. There's not a whole lot of plot twists. There's a lot of conversation in this movie. And it's really about these two characters and the romance that they have with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it was interesting. I was looking back at this, just looking at the origins of the movie, and you know, this Diane Keaton and Woody Allen had been a romantic item years before this. They weren't together anymore when they made this, but he did write this role especially for her, and you can tell it's tailor made toward her, and just their chemistry together, you can't really bottle up. It's just natural. And
yeah.
And it's just all over the movie. And the movie originally, though, Allen wanted it to be all about Alvy, and Annie Hall was just going to be kind of a peripheral character. But as you know, the chemistry between them, it seemed like, you know, people were more and more interested in the relationship instead of just him. So, which I think worked more toward the movie's advantage. But Aaron, since you're the first timer, let's start with you. What was your first impression of Annie Hall?
Okay. I may have an unpopular opinion.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was really well done. I don't really care for Alvy Singer's character in any way, shape, or form. He's painful to me.
Yeah.
He's very painful. Yeah. But it's a great movie. I understand why it has all of the accolades it has. And what I was delighted to see when I watched it is all of the ways that this film has influenced templates for rom-coms, guy meet girl stories, and a whole bunch of things that I could pick out from, you know, movies moving forward that I was like, wow, okay, this is where this has come from. So that was really cool.
Yeah. And honestly, Aaron, you're not alone in that opinion. As I watched this again, I was like, you know, a lot of the Woody Allen's comedy style was really big in the 70s. And I think we'll get into whether or not it holds up here in 2021. But Eric, we'll start with when was the first time you saw Annie Hall?
Oh boy. So, early 90s, you know, so it had been, I had recently rewatched this one actually too, prior to us deciding that we were going to do this, you know, maybe a year before. And my initial take on the movie was, wow, this is influential. You can see, this influencing a ton of stuff that came out in the 90s, especially the 90s Woody Allen movies, which were, I really got into at that time. I think right when Mighty Aphrodite came out, which was an Oscar nominated and maybe even a win for Mira Sorvino around 1993, mm-hmm. was when I decided to go back and watch Annie Hall. And that movie is very much influenced by Mighty Aphrodite, and 90s Woody Allen films are very much influenced by this one. It was unlike anything else I had ever seen, though, too. There are some choices in this one that I'm sure that we'll dig into that make this movie completely different, because there's breaking the third wall. There's talking to random characters on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not put together like any sort of Hollywood formula. The other thing that I found when I watched it the first time was, Woody Allen, I think, is America's true art house filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is more like something that you would get. And it's funny because they talk about Fellini in the movie. This is way more what you would get out of a European director or a foreign film than the typical Hollywood movie fare. And if you look at when this movie was made, too, it kind of fits into this conversation that we've been having since the summer, where there was this sea change in Hollywood starting in 1975 with Jaws. And you mentioned Star Wars, Brandon, here in this same year, where we transitioned from sort of the Cool Hand Luke Artur films, mm-hmm. into the big movie blockbusters. And Woody Allen's making a conscious choice to make a Woody Allen small film here.
Yeah, all of Woody Allen's movies before this were your typical farces. They were, you know, just, you know, pie in the face, fall on the floor comedies, with his own kind of neurotic tendencies in there. And I think this and Manhattan, I forget which came out first, but those
Manhattan
two,
is like three films later, but yeah. In 78 or something like that.
Yeah, they were the two that really started Woody Allen's sort of transformation into doing more artsy type fare, which he's best known for. And I think also the major character that's in all of his movies is New York City. I think the rest of the country's view of what New York was like was based off of what Woody Allen gave them in the movies a lot of the time. He's a major figure in Hollywood history. He's a divisive figure, which we'll get into later, some of the other stuff.
Sure.
But to see him in this period, I actually think, and you're right, his 70s stuff is great, but I think his most fruitful period was the late 80s, early 90s. Movies like Hannah and Her Sisters and Crimes and Misdemeanors and movies like that, I really love. But this movie does stand out, and I think it's because the 70s was a decade that just changed everything, like we've talked about previously with Cuckoo's Nest and everything, and this was turning the romantic comedy on its head, because the 70s was a time for pop psychology, and this movie is littered with that. And I don't think romantic comedies before that had ever so much talked about every little aspect of a relationship and explored it. So, let's talk about the characters, and let's talk about Alvy Singer first. The character that Woody portrays, and you're right. He is a grating character, and I don't necessarily know if Woody meant for him to be that way, or if he wanted him to be a little more endearing, and for some reason in 2021 it doesn't come across that way. But
that's what I was wondering.
But this is a character that just cannot find pleasure in anything, and he has to constantly, you know, see. You know, the quote at the end of the movie when they're breaking up and going through the books, I think perfectly summarizes the two characters. Annie's books are poetry. His books are about death and dying. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, so. He has a quote in the movie or a line where he's talking about, like, basically you can either pick misery or I forgot what the other thing is he's talking about, but it's like a greater form of misery. He's like, well, you can pick to be miserable or you can pick to be more miserable. So why not just pick to be miserable? And I'm like, he's just painful. I think the film's working title originally was anhedonia, which literally means the inability to feel pleasure.
Yeah.
But United Artists thought that it would be too hard to come up with an ad campaign that would give meaning to the word.
Yeah.
Really bring in an audience. So I get it, as far as an art house film goes. And even thinking back to what you guys were saying, like, up against these blockbusters, and even now, for somebody to sit down and have the attention span to, like, really enjoy this fairly short film by standards today, it's not action, it's not really showy, it's just, you know, it's just very cerebral, and there's something to be appreciated by that. But yeah, his character, man, I was wondering that same thing, like, did he want him to be this way? Was it not on purpose? Did he think... Because he's kind of got an aspect and air of, like, erudite righteousness in his self-loathing that I see in other people, like, even today in today's world. So I think that's fascinating. I don't know.
Yeah,
he's not my fave.
He looks down on other people, even though he can't like himself.
Yes.
You know, the guy in the line at the movie behind him who's has all these opinions that Alvy Singer thinks are wrong about Federico Fellini films, he looks down upon those individuals, you know?
Yeah. And people like that with me, just if you can't cheer for someone else and, like, just, like, be happy for anyone else, like, I can't vibe with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think in a way it's a courageous choice though, because at the same time we've got a cinema landscape that is full of anti-heroes. And
yeah. You know,
we've got somebody like a Travis Bickle from Taxi Driver, who's got mental health issues of his own, who for some reason is far worse off, but we cheer for more.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's almost, harder to center a movie around this Alvy Singer character that doesn't have those redeeming qualities. What I did appreciate too is he doesn't win in the end. He doesn't end up with Annie Hall. In fact, he basically tells the audience he's going to be miserable because he says it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's all of his relationships, his relationships with his family, with his romantic relationships, his relationships with his city. He can't get to Los Angeles. He can't get to love Los Angeles because he's in love with this trash heap, New York City, that is beating him down all the time. But for mm-hmm. some reason he can't quit it, you know? So
yeah. Even his best friend is like, oh my God, please just stop being like, be happy about something. Mm-hmm. Like you can't even enjoy fresh air and sunshine.
He tends to define people by location, you know, like, you know, like he had, you know, New York City, you know, are realistic, you know, people who live in the real world, and he just can't handle people who think that, you know, sunny LA is any kind of place to live. And then, you know, he makes fun of Annie's hometown constantly. And, you know, when she talks about Grammy Hall and if she lived in a Norman Rockwell painting and all of that stuff, he really defines people by, you know, where they come from. And he just can't seem to get past that. I think he, you know, and of course there's a lot of Jewish humor in this movie. And, you know, of course there's I don't know if I would call it self-loathing on his part, but I guess it is. But, you know, it's like a persecution complex that he has for himself, and he wants to live in that world. And, you know, and that those kind of people are, you know, hard to deal with also. But Woody Allen was, you know, this by 77, this legendary stand-up comic. You know, his stand-up work in the, you know, 60s, you know, top-selling comedy albums and all that stuff. And it's funny, it starts with a monologue and it ends with a monologue of him. And so it's almost like, I almost feel like he's telling us, you know, don't take anything that you're saying seriously, because this is all of this is going to be a performance piece. You know, it's all going to be inside my head. So it's interesting. Every time I go back and watch it, I'm like, okay, is he intending for this to be, you know, really poignant here? Is he just saying, you know, this is all farce? Because art plays a huge part in this movie too. Mm-hmm. But I think Allen, I think his performance in the movie is great. This is the only movie where he was actually nominated for an acting Oscar.
It's fantastic. And the character's really well written. It's pretty seamless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he just is that guy. And I don't know if it's just Woody Allen playing himself, but he really, you know, comes across as this three-dimensional character that could have been a one-dimensional, you know, caricature.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, he claims that character's not autobiographical, mm-hmm. but there's too many coincidences that lead you to believe that there's pieces of it.
Yeah.
Maybe he doesn't want it to be about autobiographical, but it just, maybe it's him amplified, you know, and it's hard to believe that he wrote that character in that way without some of that living inside of him, because it's so hard to kind of separate the two. I mean, when you think of the Woody Allen movie character, you immediately go to this Annie Hall movie, and this character kind of shows up in some other Woody Allen films, you know, when it's Woody Allen playing Woody Allen, you know, this neurotic New York Jew. So,
okay. And isn't this like the template for the whole, like, I guess the persona of Woody Allen, like what you would see in a Family Guy episode or The Simpsons, where like he's being parodied. It's this kind of character, correct?
Even his stand-up was sort of a neurotic character who would talk about sexuality and seeing an analyst or a psychologist. I mean, that came out in his stand-up too. So it's hard to separate those two.
Yeah. And this time around, I thought about, you know, when he's in LA and he's talking to Tony Roberts, his friend, and they're talking about going to the Grammys or whatever. And he said, all they do in this town is give out awards. And of course, Woody famously hates award shows the only time he has ever been at the Oscars was when he came and did a monologue in tribute to New York right after 9/11. And so that's the only time he's ever attended those, and of course didn't attend, you know, the any of the awards that this movie got in 77. But it is funny, and there's some other scenes in the movie that are unfortunately are a little autobiographical too. But he he really does. I felt sorry for him when I watched it this last time. I'm like, yeah, he gets on my nerves, but I'm like, man, I wish you didn't live in this universe. You'd be a whole lot better off.
Right. Because who wants to see, I mean, I don't want anyone to be miserable. And that's really the thing. It's more or less like, you just don't want someone to be that unhappy.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that, like, I feel like when you look at the trajectories of him and Annie, like, he kind of stays the same as miserable, if not maybe a little bit more miserable, a little bit less successful as his story arc goes, whereas she feels like she grows in, Annie grows into, like, you know, she starts off a little more meek and more unsure of herself and maybe a little more miserable and, like, self-medicating with marijuana. Not that I want to transition into her, but just like her story arc kind of, she goes a bit more on an incline, grows into some maturity. So, like, you get to see her and kind of cheer her on. Whereas he just kind of stays the same, which I think you're also kind of bummed about in a movie too, because you want to see that, you know, main character gain traction and at least start a little bit higher than they were, you know, unless it's like, I don't know, like a movie about like drug dealers where you're like, they end up in jail and you're like, okay, well, you're worse off now, but you deserved it kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Before we move on to Diane Keaton, who's the next thing I want to talk about, I guess this is the best time to talk about the elephant in the room in terms of Woody Allen, where he's concerned. A lot of people know he was married to Mia Farrow. This was about a decade or so after this movie. And he was apparently alone with her children while Mia was out, and the babysitter reported that she had seen him sexually assault one of the kids. And then, of course, there was also Mia Farrow, when she was married to the conductor Andre Previn, adopted a couple of children, and Woody Allen eventually married one of these girls, you know, who you know, he never apparently lived in the same house with, and she was an adult and all that, but it was kind of a stepdaughter of his or whatever. And she
was in her 20s.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yes, I believe so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, like, early 20s, I thought.
Yeah. And unlike other people who we have seen, you know, accused of this thing, like Kevin Spacey or Bill Cosby, Woody Allen has continued to work steadily. He has, you know, a whole group of people that still, actors, artists who still support him and want to be in his films. And he's done some incredible work since then. Movies like Midnight in Paris, which I love.
Fantastic movie.
And it's just one of those cases where you have to separate art from the artist. I know some people aren't able to do that, and that's fine. And I think that you have every right to do that. But you can't deny that he's a brilliant artist who has done some amazing work while being, you know, questionable as a human being sometimes.
Were they allegations, or was anything ever brought to?
I believe. I want to be factual about this.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm glad that you bring it up, Brandon.
Yeah.
And there are people that have worked with him in the past, including Mira Sorvino, who she came out and I think apologized for working with him, which is kind of a strange take on the Me Too movement. But she did say that she did not intend to work with him again in the future. So there are obviously things there that people think are bad enough that they don't want to work with him.
Yeah.
She came out in 2017 with the Me Too movement, or she came out prior to that?
Yeah, correct. This was, and I want to say it was something like last year. I mean, so this is
okay.
Relatively recent history.
In October of 93, the New York Child Welfare Agency closed the 14-month investigation and concluded there wasn't credible evidence of abuse or maltreatment, and the allegation was unfounded. So that's the official statement. But even, you know, Diane Keaton, you know, they're still very close. And another rare public appearance he made when when she received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Film Institute, Woody Allen came and presented it to her, and the whole room gave him a standing ovation. So, he is kind of the odd figure where, you know, he hasn't necessarily always been shunned, even though he shuns himself from society most of the time. He's kind of that rare Hollywood figure. So it's a very slippery slope in terms of Woody Allen.
Well, and if he was a director now and that happened now, he'd be canceled.
Right.
Yeah.
No one would ever work with him again. It'd be a death sentence.
You know, the strange thing, though, is that this movie was made on a budget of something like $4 million. Mm-hmm. That's the budget of his movies today. I mean, he doesn't have, you know, he's self-funding. So
he gets to
avoid some of the pitfalls that these big.
He's left alone, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we don't know much more than that. I mean, we're not Hollywood insiders. I've never met the man. So
right.
We want to.
Right. It's like when you hear that, and then you watch the movie that he wrote and directed, and there are jokes in there about
the scene that made me the most uncomfortable this time was where he's in the classroom with all the kids.
Me too.
Where in 1977 that would have been hilarious.
Right. Oh my God, Brandon, me too. I was like, ooh, no.
where the one girl who says I'm into leather. That was a little, you know, and in 1977 no one would have thought a thing about it, but you know, hindsight is 20/20.
No, they would have been like in the theaters, pregnant, smoking, drinking Diet Coke, laughing their faces off at it.
This movie does take the word that I almost said was an almost refreshing take on sexuality, though, where it's very open and sex isn't taboo at all. And I think it takes a deep dive into how sex figures into the relationships particularly between men and women.
Hands down.
Yeah. And so because of all these other things that have come out, those things seem a little strange now. But Woody Allen never shied away from that stuff. In fact, 1969, I think he made All You Ever Wanted to Know About Sex, But Were Afraid to Ask. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was not a taboo topic for him in his films.
He's very clever at tiptoeing around it to where it's not going to be censored a lot of the times. And, you know, he makes it humorous, or he uses euphemisms or things that aren't going to get you necessarily in trouble. It's hard to, I watched this movie again and I'm like, this was PG.
I know.
But, you know, PG-13 didn't exist then. So, we've covered that. So let's move on to talk about Diane Keaton, who you and I, Eric, spent a lot of time talking about Diane Keaton last year because we covered both Godfather 2 and Godfather 3. So to see her and this is probably the light I think most people know Diane Keaton as, a comedic actress. And I think she's great. To be in an audience in 77 after seeing her as Kay in the Godfather movies, this was probably a big jolt, seeing her as kind of this flighty, you know, poetic figure. But to me, this is one of Diane Keaton's signature roles. I think she is perfect. And she's the rootable person in this. You just want to, you want to root for her the whole time. Eric, what are your thoughts on Diane Keaton?
Yeah, absolutely. And you watch her and you feel like this is more who she is too, you know, and she's just a sweet, neurotic, smart, funny, fun character. You kind of figure Diane Keaton is exactly like that too.
Yeah.
And her performance is amazing. The movie's called Annie Hall. It's a piece written for her, and she carries the movie. I almost wish there were more of her in it. You know, when Aaron said you don't root for Alvy Singer, I could deal with a little less of him and more of her in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, Aaron.
She's just lovely. She's a delightful little ditzy, flighty thing. Giggly, like she's just, you know, as a quirky brunette, I'm all for the quirky brunettes, you know? So she was just, she was precious. And I just really enjoyed watching her develop through it. Like I said, like she starts off really meek and insecure in the beginning. And I, you know, that seeps through a lot. She needs to medicate herself, you know, with marijuana. She won't go see an analyst. She's really unsure of herself. And you know, I've been in relationships with people who are massive Debbie Downers, like an Alvy Singer, and that's really hard to kind of like overcome, stay above when you're with someone who kind of wants to drag you down too. Cause there are all these moments in the movie where like, she's having a good time and she wants to have a good time and she wants to elevate herself a little bit. And when he sees her get ahead a little bit, he starts to try to take her down a couple notches and bring her back down to his, you know, level. And I love watching her just kind of mature into herself, and even watching her go out to LA. And even though at the end of the movie, she comes back, she went out and she did her own thing for herself and felt grounded in that decision. Not like it was dependent upon anybody else. She got to make it for herself and see what she could do with her own career. So yeah, her Annie Hall was just adorable. And exactly like you said, Eric, like exactly how you would think that she would be in real life, like someone you'd want to hang out with on the weekends, you know, and just feel comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So she was a really well written character. And I'm just really impressed that even after having a romantic relationship, that Woody Allen and Diane Keaton could maintain such a great chemistry throughout the movie and really make it seem so palpable.
Yeah. Diane Keaton to me is one of those actresses who always has the ability to make it look like she's making it up as she goes along. It never seems scripted. And, of course the iconic moment, and it became a famous quote and saying her la-di-da's. And you know, that whole scene after the tennis match and everything, it looks like she's totally improvising everything in that scene. And she's wonderful. and I love Diane Keaton when she sings in this movie, when she does Seems Like Old Times. I think that's one of the great musical moments in movie history. And I wish Diane Keaton would sing a little more in movies, because she's got this, it's not a trained voice, but it's very melodic and pure. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what she brings. What she brings to this role, and she's the perfect balance to Alan's neuroses. She's got she's flighty, but she's grounded, and they have this amazing back and forth, and she can hold her own, and you know she's not knocked down by his cynicism the way the audience is, I feel like.
Yeah, she lets it roll off her. I mean, for a long period of time throughout the film, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I was going to say too that, you know, she's not without her neuroses as well.
Right.
Totally.
It's just how they manifest and how she deals mm-hmm. with them. So it's an interesting juxtaposition. And I think what's great too is we get to see so much of Alvy Singer's background to be able to go see Annie Hall's when we, you know, go to Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Is that the state or mm-hmm. Minnesota? Yep.
I
think it's Wisconsin. Yeah.
And you see her family and her background, and it's very different than the background that Alvy Singer, but then at the same time, it's not so different. It's family mm-hmm. dynamics, and they all have their own weird characters in their families that influence who they are. It's a great parallel. And Diane Keaton, you don't expect her to be as wacky as she is at the beginning, and then it kind of slowly seeps out.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So this movie, I don't really think there's any other character like worth digging into in this movie. They're all kind of peripheral supporting characters, but it's yeah.
Can we talk though for 1 second about the 5 minutes that Christopher Walken's on screen?
Oh yeah, yeah. I was gonna say this movie has so many people that were just about to make it big.
It's crazy. And
it's amazing. But yeah. Christopher Walken, go ahead, Aaron. Yeah.
No, I just like I love this movie. Is super clever. And it is. It's so well written. It's so funny. But I just love that, like, as you're watching it, like, all of a sudden, here's Christopher Walken being Christopher Walken before he was Christopher Walken.
Right.
Just
before,
like,
that was a thing.
Yes. Being intense and creepy for 5 minutes and, like, Woody Allen being like, all right. And then, like, moving on. And that's it. And I'm like, oh, this is brilliant.
It's brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, that was it. But yeah, there's so many amazing cameos.
Yeah, because a year later, Walken would do The Deer Hunter and win an Oscar. And, you know, so that's just on, you know, and I think I read it was that scene in Annie Hall that got him that job in The Deer Hunter. Wow. So yeah, he was just on the precipice of that. And then you've got Jeff Goldblum, who gets one line.
I forgot my mantra.
Yes.
I mean, there's nothing more in mid-70s than that line there.
Yeah, absolutely. This movie is very much a lot of the humor in this movie is timeless, but a lot of the aesthetic of the movie is not timeless. It's very 70s. Right. But
I did want to point out too, then we've got Paul Simon, who's the philosopher king of the 1970s, playing this character who's the philosopher king, you know, and he mentions having a party with Jack and Angelica, I believe, which was totally something that was going on in the 70s. And it's just this weird sort of, this is probably one of the first, like, really meta films where things that are going on are referencing real world events too.
Well, Truman Capote, where he's like, oh, that guy wins.
Great line.
Yes, the Truman Capote lookalike contest, and it's actually him.
And you have Marshall McLuhan, who gets pulled out to settle the argument. And if people don't know who he, people don't know who he is. He was a philosopher from the mid 20th century. He's the one that coined the phrase global village. He's the one that said the medium is the message, things like that. He was very much into media philosophy. And so that was very funny. And apparently, someone who had spoke in front of crowds so many times, when he got in front of a movie camera, froze, and it took them forever to do that scene. Mm-hmm. but apparently he wanted Federico Fellini to do that cameo, and they were going to do, but Fellini didn't want to do it or something, apparently. But I think McLuhan works just as better. But again, that kind of dates the movie a little bit too. But you've got Carol Kane earlier in her career, who still comes off as quirky, but not as quirky as she would be later on. And then you've got Shelley Duvall, just at the start of her career. And it's amazing, all of these people in this one little movie that are about to hit it big. And Shelley Duvall's, Shelley Duvall always has kind of quirkiness to her, the way that Carol Kane did too. And she's great as kind of that backstage, groupie that he ends up taking home with him. But any other smaller characters that you can think of?
In the last scene, when you wouldn't know it unless you looked up the credits or read any of the trivia, but in the very one of the last scenes when Alvy and Annie end up meeting up later on, the woman that Alvy's with is Sigourney Weaver. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, what? And I was like, right. It was right before she hit it too. It's wild.
It is wild. It absolutely is.
I mean,
is.
So like, you just can't deny the genius of Woody Allen in his script and his cast, casting. And because I'm assuming he's got a hand in who's taking what roles as well.
Oh, in his films. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And also Annie's mom in the movie is played by an actress named Colleen Dewhurst, who was a legendary theater actress. Mm. And for kids who grew up in the 80s, 90s, she was also in Anne of Green Gables on the Disney Channel. That's what I remember it from. But a brilliant actress too. So yeah, he had the ability to just sprinkle in all of these wonderful actors that he could pull from New York most of the time, because a lot of these people who would become movie stars were on the stage at that point. So amazing stuff. Let's move on though, and we'll probably get into more of these people when we talk about favorite scenes. Eric, what's a favorite scene of yours from this movie? The scenes of this movie aren't very long. They're all very rapid.
Yeah, and some of them are great comedic bits, some of them are great rom-com bits. The scene I think that probably is the pop culture world has to be, though, when Alvy and Annie take a little vacation somewhere and they get the live lobsters.
Yes.
And it's just a great scene of chemistry between them. Woody Allen playing Woody Allen. I mean, that you can picture that guy picking up the lobster and just being so squeamish like he is with it. And it's just a great, it's a great piece of why you can see why she fell in love with him. You know, he's neurotic, but he's funny at the same time. And it's probably, in my mind, the best scene in the entire movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's so natural. And yeah, it's a charming scene. It's when Woody gets to be the least neurotic, I feel. I mean, he's still neurotic, but it's a charming neurotic.
Right.
And,
right.
It's really, yeah. That's a really fun scene. And I'm sure that Woody just told his cameraman to keep it on them. And he and Diane just kind of went with whatever happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Aaron, what do you have a favorite scene?
You know, the scene that's really sticking out to me, which, like you guys said, there's so many good ones, but just where they're sitting there and they're trying to talk him into doing cocaine. And they're like, ah, come on, everybody try it. You know, the guy's like, ah, when you're going to California, can you get me some cocaine? And he's holding the little container as this gentleman is cutting lines. And he's like, that's about $2,000 worth of cocaine there. And then Alvy puts a dab of it in his nose and then sneezes the whole thing out all over the place. Like it's so clever. This whole movie is so clever. What other movie? I mean, scenes do I like? There's really.
I love when they're first driving together and she's just,
oh my God,
she's the speed
terrible.
Demon. But to me, the funny thing is he's criticizing her driving. And then when he gets to LA, he's a terrible driver too. Terrible.
Yeah. He's not even driving, but he's criticizing everyone else's driving.
Yeah. It's great. I also, but we talked about there's just clever techniques in this movie that just weren't ever used before. Like, you know, the two of them will be having a conversation and there'll be subtitles underneath of what they're really thinking. And then,
There because that is a great scene too. I mean, I don't think we had ever seen anything like that before where you have two people at the very beginning of their relationship and they're giving their dialogue and then we get to hear what's going on in their head. And it's just,
awesome.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And you see everything from, you know, how much they like each other to boy, did that sound stupid to everything that has occupied our own brains. And it's just so real. It's great.
I love, besides the breaking of the fourth wall, I love how the movie is interspersed with scenes where they are kind of stepping into a memory and watching it. I love that. It's so Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
100%, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, like I just love being able to see all of these different types of scenes in this movie and go, oh my gosh, this is where they got this, you know, this is where this movie pulled this from. It's from Annie Hall. I loved, seeing the split screen of them like in therapy and talking about their different, you know, how they're feeling like when they're talking about sex and the analysts are asking them and he's like, oh, we never have sex. It's only 3 times a week. And she's like, all the time, 3 times a week.
We also get animation in this movie as well, a little bit where whoever thought you would hear the Wicked Queen talking about menstruation.
But, oh my gosh, yes.
Which, by the way, would not happen now. Disney would never allow something like that to happen.
And I'm sure they didn't get permission from. Well, and this was the 70s, so the Disney company was not as powerful as they are now.
No, they were struggling.
Because Walt had passed away. And it was about another decade before they regained their footing again. But he got that kind of at the right moment. But there's so what I enjoy is the majority of the movie in New York has a color palette that's pretty like gray and brown. And then when you get to LA, it's a totally different looking movie cinematography wise. It's all white and bright, and it's a totally different aesthetic. And I think what people sometimes don't realize is the city of New York was in dire straits in the 70s. The mm-hmm. people were leaving it in droves. Mayor Ed Koch went to President Ford and asked him to bail out the city of New York, and Ford said no way. And and you know, crime was up. Times Square was not the family friendly tourist attraction it was now. You know, it was all drug dealers and prostitutes at that time. Mm-hmm. And so New York was,
he's like, I love this city, what's wrong with it? Everyone else who lived outside of it were jerks. That's hilarious, right? I love it.
What I like too, that the scenes of them getting around New York, they're always finding water. They're always finding these picturesque places to be in New York too. Mm-hmm. Even the scene where they're sitting on the park bench and they are, you know, the winner of the Truman Capote lookalike contest, where they're just sitting there, they're just crowd watching. It's really beautiful. And it's, definitely a love letter to that city as well, and for everything that was wrong with it, you could say, well, it doesn't look that bad, you know. You could,
right?
I'd still go visit New York City.
Oh yeah, you know?
I mean, clearly how Woody Allen felt about the city is very much conveyed not only through those aspects visually, but also through obviously his character sentiments about it, and in comparison to the rest of the country, which mm-hmm. is cool.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And the other scene that kind of tickled me was, and I'm sure this was pure Woody Allen, but when he and Tony Roberts, his friend, were, when they're in the booth doing the laugh tracks for the sitcom, and how Alvy just thinks it's a total sin to add any kind of
laugh. Which, you know, another brief cameo appearance, Beverly D'Angelo is
right.
One of the actresses in the show that they're watching. Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, so good. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do love at the end, you know, where he's written his little, you know, play that's based off of his relationship, and I think that's one of the themes of the movie, is that, you know, with art, you can kind of make life what you want it to be. And mm-hmm. I think that's kind of what the whole movie is, because, you know, you start with him telling the story and you end with him telling the story, and it's all kind of him concocting, you know, his thoughts about everything that's been going on. And yeah.
And along that theme, I love that anytime that he wants to go see a movie, he goes and sits and watches the 4-hour
Sorrow
and the Pity documentary about World War II, too. I mean, that is just like, you can make life whatever you want. That's his choice. And it's this running theme throughout the movie, and it's great. Yeah,
totally.
Well, and at the beginning when they're going to, and they've missed the first 2 minutes and he's freaking out about it. Yes. She's like, the longer we stand here talking, And I love the little nod, you know, with Diane Keaton being there when he's talking to those guys on the street and he goes, I'm out here with the cast of The Godfather. And I thought that was a great meta joke.
And apparently one of those guys, too, is also an extra in The Godfather. Yeah.
Crazy.
On top of Diane Keaton actually being in it. I know. It's just like there are really layers of intelligence in this movie, uh-huh. In the script and everything else. I love the line, too, when they're arguing and Annie's trying to be like, you gotta stop masturbating so much, and he's like, don't knock masturbation, it's sex with somebody I love.
Right. Yeah, it's man, I still for this to be 1977 and for him to be so intelligent and forthcoming with a lot of, you know, some of this dialogue, especially regarding sex, it's pretty bold, even though he'd been doing, as you mentioned, Eric, he'd been doing it probably since the late 60s.
But I think that you had mentioned this already, Brandon, but this is the departure. This is the film mm-hmm. that takes Woody Allen from you know, those films like Bananas and Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Sex were farces. They're screwball kind of comedies. Mm-hmm. And they're series of bits. This one's got a whole nother layer of depth to it and is a real turn for Woody Allen as a filmmaker.
There's a poignancy to this movie too.
Yeah.
That you wouldn't find. It is a comedy, but it's not a pure comedy. There's something, you know, there's a tinge of sadness in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just looking at looking at it, as you mentioned before, it was a $4 million budget, but it ended up making $38.3 million. So definitely made its money back. And of course, was, you know, far from the highest grossing movie of the year because a little movie called Star Wars comes out. But yeah, it's really the 70s is such a crazy decade because you've got blockbusters and these kinds of movies that do well at the box office. And it's funny, a movie like Annie Hall would go straight to streaming mm-hmm. nowadays. I don't think you would even get a theatrical release for it.
You know, and it's so funny, like, I'm kind of getting the, like, image in my head right now of, like, in 1977, like, you probably still had a significant group of people who saw a movie like Star Wars or, like, Jaws and were like, ugh. Like, they wanted to go see Annie Hall. They wanted their Fillmore art house. You know, so it kind of reminds me of that line, too, where they're in L.A. and Annie is like, oh, my gosh, it's so clean out here. And Alvy is like, yeah, in Beverly Hills, they don't throw their garbage away. They turn it into television. Like, she's still so haughty about it. And I feel like there were probably people in the 70s, like, with Star Wars, like, still just being like, ugh. Like, they, that wasn't, it, I probably still felt a little kitschy to a certain crowd at the time.
Sure. Oh, sure. Certainly. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking at the Oscar nominations, it was nominated for 5 Oscars and won 4. The only one that it lost was Woody Allen for Best Actor. The winner that year was Richard Dreyfuss for The Goodbye Girl, which is much more of a likable character for a comedy, though. And it's funny, comedies, you know, in the history of the Oscars, you know, usually don't stand a chance. There's been 6 comedies that have won Best Picture, and Annie Hall was the 6th. The comedy has not won since 1977.
Wow.
For Best Picture. So, and it won Best Picture, and it's funny that these were the nominees. You had Annie Hall, you had The Goodbye Girl, Julia, which is like a World War II drama with Jane Fonda and Vanessa Redgrave. Then you had Star Wars, and then you had The Turning Point, which is a drama about ballet with Shirley MacLaine and Anne Bancroft. So very wide. And this is also the year Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out. So you had wide variety. And then Diane Keaton does win for Best Actress. And then Woody wins as Best Director. And then the screenplay wins. So quite. And it was a big year because it was Oscar's 50th anniversary and stuff. And so for like this little romantic comedy to have won was kind of an interesting thing. And kind of, as you mentioned, Eric, just a turning point.
Yeah. I'm a little surprised cinematography didn't get nominated because this film is it's beautifully shot. It's skillfully shot too. When you realize that there's a lot of there's walking and talking and there's street scenes and they're all lit the same way and they all really work really well. Those dream sequences work well. You know, the whole Christopher Walken driving the car. I mean, those those are all great cinematography scenes too.
Yeah, and editing is kind of another thing, because this movie is so fast paced and everything, you would think the editors would be recognized too. But yeah, interesting. And then taking a look at the AFI lists and everything, it was added to the National Film Registry in 1992. It was number 4 on the list of funniest movies of all time, number 11 on the greatest romances of all time. La-di-da, la-di-da was the 55th greatest movie quote of all time. Seems Like Old Times at number 90 was number 90 on the greatest movie songs of all time. And then it's number 35 on the 100 greatest films of all time. So it's still thought of in very high regard.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but Woody Allen didn't think too highly of this own film.
Kind of like I said before, he wanted it to be solely about the psyche of Alvy Singer, and people were responding more to the love story between Annie and Alvy, and I don't think he wanted it to be as much of a romantic comedy as it ended up being.
And I don't think that's the movie that he set out to make. But he should have let it go, because sometimes you don't get the movie you set out to make and something better happens.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And sometimes directors have a hard time, you know, that if you really have a vision for something and it's not the vision you wanted, even if it's a better product, you might never admit that.
Just like with Cats and Tom Cooper.
I think that's the first Cats reference we've had on Classics. So good job, Eric.
We even had
Lou on last year, and I don't think he mentioned cats once. So,
I imagine with this film particularly, if you upon subsequent viewings, you could dive more into like the psyche and really concentrate on like certain characters and pieces. But I could see that like the first viewing, yes, you're focusing at face value on the relationship, but I think you could do character studies for subsequent viewings.
Yeah.
And pick up on those things that he's disappointed in that weren't front and center.
Well, and my wife was like, "Oh, you're doing Annie Hall." And she said, "You know, that's an interesting topic today, you know, because at the time her recollection was, and currently her recollection was that this was a feminist movie because Annie and Alvy don't get together at the end." And I kind of had that in my mind when I watched it this last time. It's funny because I think it probably would have been considered very much a feminist movie at the time.
Yeah, but single girl in New York.
Yeah. Yeah, but now at 2021, it's like, boy, it's really not. He treats her poorly. Annie doesn't learn. He does not learn a lesson here. So, I mean, it's very much not a pro woman.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit.
Yeah, that's what we're here for, you know, to have a conversation about that. But, you know, my thought is that if this movie were made today, it would look very, very different. And Annie Hall would be 90% Annie Hall, 10% Alvy Singer, instead of sort of this kind of backwards way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I guess, though, back to my point originally, you're right. He's not nice to her at all. And like I said, he's like crabs in a bucket. Like she's trying to get out and he's pulling her down. But where I diverge a little bit and I guess see the feminist aspect of it is she ultimately doesn't let it hold her back. She does go on and do what she wants. Like I said, I did appreciate that about her character arc, that she seemed to get stronger and more sovereign in herself, where she relies on him more for validation and for some things in the beginning and not so much at the end. You know, at the end, she's going, you know what? I do want to go my own way. I do like my own things. I do have my own path to forge. So in that aspect, I do appreciate it. And especially for the 70s of her deciding to move cross country. I mean, first of all, she left Wisconsin to go to a big, apparently dirty and crime ridden city.
Yeah.
All by herself. She meets this guy. He's a schmuck. You know, and then eventually through that learns more about herself. She goes through therapy, even though it's with his coaxing. But then she kind of forges her own adventure. And I do appreciate that about it. So that's where I give a little bit of the pushback on that.
Yeah.
But I do see
I appreciate that position 100%.
I do see where you're coming from, because he's not nice at all. Like
it takes he thrives in the cesspool of New York. She thrives in the more, you know, open LA.
That's a good point.
And of course, you know, she ends up coming back to New York and lives in, you know, Soho, I think he says at the end. And I do love, we haven't talked about it, but I do love his analogy at the end, though, about romance and everything, about, you know, my friend who thinks he's a, you know, chicken, you know, well, why don't you take him to therapy? Because I need the eggs. And that's a great, and, you know, that's kind of when I sort of feel that Alvy may have taken a bit of a turn. You know, he's still going to be the, you know, cynical guy he's always been, but maybe he's softened just a bit.
A little more self-aware.
Mm-hmm. And of course, and I love, and we didn't talk about it, but he uses the great Groucho Marx, you know, quote a couple times, "I wouldn't want to belong to any society that, or any club that would have me as a member."
Yeah.
Which is also kind of the, his kind of view of romance too. I think he just can't find pleasure in anything. He doesn't necessarily trust a woman who would, you know, be attracted to him.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then I'm sure that's a whole other bag of worms with Woody Allen.
Right. Too,
but... Yeah. Yeah. He's got a lot of bags.
Yeah.
A lot of bags that need to be unpacked. Yeah.
So,
I mean, I think I agree with you too, Eric. There are things in this film that obviously in 2020 don't translate into today that would never make it into a film today and really have no place in a film today. You know, some of them, like I'm thinking of particularly, you know, he has this scene, comes into her apartment because she needs help with the spider. And he picks up this was a good joke earlier. I guess he made a joke about Dissent, which was a liberal magazine, and Commentary, which was a conservative magazine. And he said they combined and made Dysentery.
Dysentery.
But so he comes into her apartment and he's like, he grabs, is it the National Review, which I think is a conservative. And he was like, who are you becoming? Like, he's so appalled by this. And then he goes into her room and grabs that black soap. And then makes a really terrible remark and says, like, what
about
are you?
A minstrel show.
Yeah. You know, so there are definitely aspects of this show in it, probably from the feminist aspect, and then other cultural things just would not make it today and shouldn't.
Right.
I do love that he has all those impeach buttons, impeach Johnson, impeach Nixon, impeach.
That was hilarious. Everybody.
That is fun. Every president of the modern era he wanted to impeach.
But I think that spoke to his character too. Like, it was just like, yeah, all of them, I'm better than all of them. Get rid of them. So you know, everybody. No one's safe.
Some timeless, mostly timeless humor, some dated humor, but it all still works. So as we move to sort of wrapping things up here, Eric, final thoughts on Annie Hall?
Yeah, and it's interesting to see this one in 2021. Mm-hmm. I do think that this movie, in a lot of different ways, is greater than the sum of its parts. So I think that it's significant today, and I think it's going to be significant for a very long time to come. I mean, Aaron mentioned it before. It's influential on so many different things, and not only in film, but you watch a show like Seinfeld. It's like they took that movie and they were like, okay, you know, what's going on in the mind of a comic? And we're going to make a show about that.
This is kind of a movie about nothing.
I mean, and it really is. It's not about nothing. It's really just this guy and then his particular relationship with this woman, which sounds boring, but it's not. I mean, it's a great movie for a lot of different reasons. So go watch it. If you like Woody Allen and Diane Keaton together, Manhattan Murder Mystery, which was an early 90s Woody Allen film, which is kind of an homage to Rear Window. Fantastic movie. Go check that one out too. Yeah.
Yep. Aaron, final thoughts?
It's definitely a recommendation for me. I'm so glad you guys, I don't know if I would have like ever actively made time for it, you know, if I hadn't, you guys hadn't invited me on. So I recommend it to anyone who's listening to go watch it if you haven't already. But I agree with you, Eric, it's timeless. I love looking back and seeing the influence. I can see High Fidelity. I can see 500 Days of Summer. I can see When Harry Met Sally. I can see Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Mm-hmm. You know, Forget Paris. Like I feel like a lot of Billy Crystal and maybe, you know, where he's maybe gained inspiration from some of these films. So I'm so glad I watched it. I love it. And I agree with you. I think it's going to be relevant now and in the future.
Yeah, for me, this is a movie that probably someone maybe of our generation and younger, if you saw it come on TV, you might, you know, want to skip the channel or, you know, think it's not relevant to you today. But I would suggest people give it a chance because relationship topics are forever relevant, and you're going to find something in it that you relate to, even if the character of Alvy drives you nuts. I think it's important if you're interested in the history of comedy and movies, if you're interested in the history of just movies in general. This is one to definitely watch because it came along at an important period of time when everything was changing, and this was one of the harbingers of that. And it's a great performance too by Diane Keaton, if you want to, you know, be familiar with all of her work as well. And yeah, it's just a movie that it does leave you, as cynical as some of the characters are, it does leave you with a smile on your face at the end. So and that's something that we could all use right now too. So as we wrap up, we have got some big stuff coming up. But Aaron, what have you guys got coming up on Flashbacks?
Well, depending on when this episode drops, like mm-hmm. we are obviously in February, so we've already on our personal feed dropped Trainspotting. And then for a real pick me up,
another rom com, another romp through a heroin filled.
Oh God, it's so depressing. It's so good, but so depressing. And then for on the lighter side of Flashbacks in February, we are going to be doing Pretty in Pink.
Oh, very nice.
That is a pick me up.
35th year anniversary.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Wow, man. Yeah, so, Eric, what do we have coming up here on Classics?
Well, we've got quite a bit scheduled, and the most eminent thing, I guess, that we should talk about is for February, we are going to do a discussion on the movie His Girl Friday, and that movie was suggested to us by one of our listeners. Erin Van Tassel reached out to us via Facebook. I believe actually she sent us an email, correct, email. Brandon? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll go over how anybody can contact us, and suggested that movie, and we thought, absolutely. That is a great suggestion, and we want to do more of that. So if anyone has further suggestions, please reach out to us. And then we've got a couple of big things brewing that I'm not sure that we want to spoil. Right. Definitely March is going to be good, and April is going to be a big month for, mm-hmm. for classics as well.
Yeah. In March, we're going to be talking about Patton, and our friend Jay Hoffman from Flashbacks will be joining us for that one. So to give us the military point of view for that movie. And then also for His Girl Friday, we're going to have two of our friends from Beyond the Mouse join us, Brett and Vanessa. So yeah. I figured it's a movie all about witty banter. We need two people who are experts at witty banter, and Brett and Vanessa will bring that. So a lot of great stuff coming up, and we're rolling here a lot of content throughout all of the Front Row. You know, you can keep an eye on us on our Facebook page and Twitter and all of that to see all of the big stuff that we have coming up for classics. As Eric mentioned, you can always email us at classicsfrn@gmail.com. We also have our classics Facebook page. You can also find us on Instagram at ClassicsFRNPod, and if you want to suggest something, we will do it as long as it was made before 1980, because otherwise our Flashbacks friends will get mad at us. Mm-hmm.
Pick up you guys, though. We don't have it for that much longer.
But Eric and I, we've already got the rest of 2021 planned out, and we've got a great group of movies of every conceivable type of genre coming out. So keep on the lookout for that. So as we close this episode of Front Row Classics, I'm Brandon Davis.
I'm Eric Flick.
And I'm Aaron McCabe.
And we will see you in the front row.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.